Good afternoon. My name is Avery, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the MS Research Update. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there'll be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you'd like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Mr. Clark. You may begin your conference.
Thank you, Adrian. This is Erica DeClerc, a team member from the National MS Society, and I join Adrian in welcoming you all today to this special conversation. I am pleased to introduce my colleague, Dr. Tim Cootsey, who has been a leader in the pursuit of innovative ways to move us all closer to a free world free of multiple sclerosis. Since receiving his PhD in microbiology and immunology in 1993, Dr. Cootsey has contributed to the field of MS research in numerous ways, from his postdoctoral work researching the structure and function of myelin to ultimately helping to create programs such as the Society's Translational Research Partnerships in Nervous System Repair and Protection in MS, pioneering investments in commercial therapy development, and creation of a global alliance focusing on research in progressive MS, which we'll get to hear more about later on in the call. Dr. Cootsey has demonstrated proven ability to create critical partnerships and effective collaborations worldwide to move research and treatment forward faster for people affected by all forms of MS. He oversees all of the National MS Society's mission delivery efforts in advocacy, services, and research. Tim, I am thrilled to turn this conversation over into your capable hands.
Also, thank you, Erica, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Erica, next time I have to make sure my son joins us so that he can listen to all of that, so you might be suitably impressed, I'm hoping. I am actually delighted to be joined by three colleagues who are individuals that I'm really pleased that all of our friends and supporters who are with us today hear from, and you just really get to meet. And part of what I hope you'll hear today is a lot of excitement and progress about the Society's goals to stop MS and to restore lost function and end MS forever. The focus of our call today is to highlight the progress that's being made specifically in the area of progressive MS, and in particular highlighting some of the work that is done through the Progressive MS Alliance, which we'll hear about in a few more minutes. To do this, you fortunately don't have to listen to me for an hour. I have two recipients of the Progressive MS Alliance's first round of grants joining us for our conversation today. So I'm pleased to be joined by Drs. David Pitt and Nancy Schiavarlotti. Welcome, David and Nancy.
Thank you.
Hello.
And before we speak with David and Nancy, I'm also pleased to introduce my colleague, Dr. Doug Landsman, who is a Society staff member who serves as the Senior Director for International Programs. Doug specifically has responsibility for the Progressive MS Alliance. And so, Doug, welcome.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you, Doug. So just to give our listeners a little bit about a background about you, Doug joined the Society earlier this year. He brings over 12 years of experience in patient advocacy, particularly in the research area. Before joining the Society, Doug had been the Director of Special Initiatives at the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, which many of you will probably recall is the organization that was formed after Christopher Reeve's experienced spinal cord injury, and it's very focused. Doug's efforts there were very focused on first developing their research strategy, but also more recently developing strategic initiatives and programs that were really aimed at building up the foundation's interaction and capabilities with their stakeholders. He was very involved in the Reeve Foundation's research activities in both basic and clinical research and managed many of their funding programs. He also, in addition to doing all of that, had been a researcher himself, getting a PhD in neuroscience and doing work in spinal cord injury and nerve regeneration at University of Pennsylvania. So, Doug, thanks for being here today. So, tell us a little bit about the Alliance and what it is and what some of the goals of the Alliance are.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for that introduction. The Alliance, one of the easiest ways to think about it is a coalition of international MS societies working together to fund research on progressive MS. It's a very exciting program, and there's a lot of energy and efforts being put forth by a number of societies around the world to pool their talents and expertise to help move research forward on progressive MS.
Mm-hmm. So is it fair to say that this is really the first time where MS societies from around the world are pooling their both funds and expertise to address a specific research issue?
I think so. And it's novel, it's creative, it's strategic, and the partners are really terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And the list of partners is growing. And if you don't mind, I'll actually name the partners right
sure.
now. So, so the founding members include the MS societies of the United States, Canada, Italy, the United Kingdom, Australia has recently joined. We also have partnerships with Denmark, Belgium, the Netherlands, Spain, and an umbrella organization called the MS International Federation, which helps connect MS societies from around the world in addition to the ones I just named.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, as you do your work, you're a relatively new member to the society staff. I know that it's not just you and I that are doing this work. Tell us a little bit about some of the other individuals that are sort of working with you in really implementing the work of the Alliance.
Yeah, what's really neat about this is that all of the managing members have put forth professional staff, that is, scientists with many, many years of experience working on MS research to work together. And so really the heads of research from the Canada MS Society and UK and Italy, we're all working together at a very high level to come together. So it's a really neat team of colleagues that are working together.
That's great. So I know that we're going to talk about a couple of the grants that were funded through the most recent round that you know Nancy and David have. Could you tell us a little bit about you know what was the focus in terms of the Alliance's first sort of investments? What were the sort of ideas that we were looking for? And you know what did the total commitment look like in terms of number of projects we're funding and you know and the sort of total commitment that we were making?
Yeah, so the first round of grants were essentially short-term innovative pilot studies to fill knowledge and infrastructure gaps in the world of progressive MS. They were looking at areas such as identifying and testing potential treatments, understanding nerve degeneration, building data banks and biobanks, essentially tissue repositories of biological samples for use in research, all to better understand long-term imaging, genetics, and outcomes associated with progressive MS. The Alliance funded 22 research grants to investigators in 9 countries with the goal of removing barriers to treatments for progressive MS. And these 22 projects were selected from out of 195 applications that were reviewed by the Alliance. That's an incredibly strong showing of applications and interest in investigators focused on progressive MS.
Mm-hmm. So 195 sounds like so that sounds like a lot. Is it a lot?
It is a lot. I can tell you the most I had been involved with previously in grant reviews was maybe 145 applications in one grant review cycle. So 195 is a lot, and the Alliance really needed to be creative and but work as a team to review these in the most professional to peer review these in the most professional manner possible. And it was a terrific review process, and it helped identify the most promising and excellent applications from the group.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And you know, just in a couple of terms about process. So as I recall, the 22 projects were selected through a peer review process that we managed. Can you tell us a little bit more about this? Who we brought together to make these decisions about which projects were going to be funded?
Right. So the way peer review works is that we invite expert scientists to review individual applications, identify the strengths and weaknesses of each application, and then discuss these applications as a group and provide a rank order of all the applications that were received, really, you know, giving them grades, essentially, you know, if we were doing it on a 1 through 10 scale and 10 were the best, and then you take averages and you create a list of what the best applications are. And that's what we did for all 195 applications, is they were reviewed by multiple independent investigators, people that were not conflicted, that didn't have anything to lose or gain by reviewing the applications. And then we got together and we rank ordered them and came up with a terrific list of projects to fund. And ultimately, which I didn't mention before, in this first round, we're supporting approximately $2 million worth of research projects. And that's just the beginning of this of the exciting research funded by the Alliance.
Great. Well, we're going to talk to David and Nancy momentarily about their projects, but I'd be interested also just about the future. So we've done this first round of projects. We've got some good ideas, created some momentum. I know that the Alliance has a long-term goal of, you know, raising and putting over $30 million towards research that's focused on progressive MS, and you know, we at the United States Society are going to be, you know, committing at least half of that. Tell us a little bit about what's next for the Alliance.
Yeah, that's incredibly exciting what's coming up, and what we're planning for, and what we're going to be releasing a request for applications next week is for new collaborative network awards. And this new funding initiative is designed to accelerate the development of therapies for progressive MS. And these collaborative network awards are intended to challenge scientists from around the world, again, to pursue innovative, rigorous research within collaborative networks. These are meant to be interdisciplinary, global, and we're going to be focused on efforts really looking at developing new therapies for progressive MS, including new and repurposed drugs, rehabilitation strategies, and other approaches. And hopefully we're going to be able to establish teams of excellence and achieve tangible improvements in the very near future.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, thank you for that update. I think that, you know, what excites me about the Alliance is, you know, as we as a National MS Society, you know, have been able to really play an important role in creating a new approach to working together to address progressive MS. So thank you, Doug, for your leadership on that. Just so that our listeners know, when Doug started, his literal first day on the job started getting on a plane, you know, in Newark Airport to fly to London where the peer review meetings were happening. And so we threw Doug into the deep water really quickly, but he's really done terribly well. So,
well, I got to say, to everybody that we're working with is just terrific. And that's really the takeaway here, is that the entire Alliance is fantastic and focused on this.
Excellent. Well, thank you. So now I've teed up. I want to shift gears to talk a little bit about two of our grant recipients for this first round, Dr. David Pitt and Nancy Sciarrolotti. So first off, Dr. David Pitt is a physician who received his medical degree from the University of Marburg in Germany. He then did postdoctoral training at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and also did a neurology residency at the same time as the chief resident, and then moved on to do another fellowship in MS and neuroimmunology at Washington University in St. Louis. David then took a faculty position at Yale University, where he now is doing research that focuses on some of the more fundamental aspects as well as the translational aspects that looks at neurodegeneration, which is a long word for saying, you know, trying to figure out what causes the brain to break down in MS. He's funded by the National MS Society as well as the National Institutes of Health, as well as now through the Alliance. So welcome, David.
Hello, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So, and also joining us is Dr. Nancy Sciarvalotti, who is the Director of Neuropsychology and Neuroscience and Traumatic Brain Injury Research at the Kessler Foundation in West Orange, New Jersey. Dr. Sciarvalotti is also the Associate Professor at the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Rutgers University, New Jersey Medical School. She received her PhD in clinical psychology and neuropsychology at MCP, Hahnemann University in Pennsylvania. In Philadelphia. Nancy also received additional training at Brown University and at the University of Medicine and Dentistry in New Jersey. Dr. Sciarvalotti is a licensed psychologist who conducts research in cognition and the mechanisms for improving cognition in a variety of neurological disorders. She has over 85 peer-reviewed scientific publications, and focuses a lot of her work on cognitive rehabilitation in people with MS and traumatic brain injury. So, Nancy, welcome to our call today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So I'm going to kick things off with a question to Nancy to ask you to, first of all, talk to me a little bit about your impressions about the Progressive MS Alliance. Is it having the kind of impact in the research community that you heard Doug and I talk about?
It's actually having, I would say, I don't think you can quantify what a large impact it's having on the research community. What the Alliance is providing is the funding available for researchers across the world to work together to uniquely tackle the problem of progressive MS. Progressive MS provides some additional challenges in answering some of the questions we need to answer because it is a little bit more difficult to recruit these patients for research studies. And it's largely because it's less common. 80% of persons with MS at any one point in time have relapsing remitting MS. So by virtue of just a large recruitment, you get more people with relapsing remitting MS than primary progressive or secondary progressive. So this provides us with the funding to recruit large samples of persons with progressive MS and also the funding to really work together and put our heads together in an effort to solve the problems that are unique to this particular population. So it is having a tremendous impact, and I think we've only seen the beginning. It's really great to see thought leaders in the field come together and work together to build a project because many of these studies really need to be multi-site. So in the coming years, I think we're going to see some great things from the Alliance.
Oh, no, that's great to hear. And, you know, I know that your research focuses on really what is a troubling symptom that I know many people with MS share with me about their frustration about memory and cognition challenges. So as you see people with MS, you know, how big of an issue is it? Are these symptoms that people are talking about in terms of memory and cognition problems?
It's a huge issue. If you just take a minute and think about your cognition and particularly your memory, that is what makes you who you are as a human being. If you lost your memory functioning completely, you would lose everything about you. It's the way you react to situations, the way you process situations, your opinions about things. These are all formed over the years through memory processes and other aspects of cognition. So when we disrupt, when our cognition is disrupted for any reason, it has a tremendous impact on our ability to function in our environment and on our daily life. And that can be seen, many people think of cognition as important only to those people who really try to stay in the workforce. And it is particularly problematic to those persons, but it's not any less problematic to someone who is at home and maybe they may be caring for children, they may be just interacting with their family on a daily basis, doing the normal things that we do in our everyday lives. We rely on our memory functioning and our cognitive abilities in general tremendously. So when they get interrupted, but in any way, it really has a severe impact on our daily life. And when patients complain about it, they're seeking help, and we're limited in our ability to provide effective help. And that's where the research that I'm doing comes in.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about that research. So I know that you, in your grant, you talk about using what we describe as the modified story memory technique. So what is that? And you know, so tell me a little bit about the project and what you're hoping to achieve with that.
Sure. Well, the story memory technique has been developed over the years at Kessler Foundation. And what it entails is essentially 10 sessions where patients come in and meet with a clinician. And within those 10 sessions, they're taught two specific skills to help them remember information. So if you think about your daily life and learning information in your daily life, most of our tasks in our daily lives are verbally based, which means we use words. We use words all the time. And what that means is we have to remember words. And remembering words can be very challenging for someone who has MS. And what this study does is it gives people additional mechanisms to help them remember words and other verbal information. And those two mechanisms are first imagery. So first what we're teaching patients to do is take verbal information such as words and connect it with a visual image. And then the second skill we're teaching is context. So we're teaching people to take what information that they think is unrelated and put it together in a meaningful context. And the context that we use in our treatment is stories. So we're teaching patients to take unrelated words and put them in a story. Then on top of that, we're teaching them to apply the imagery they learned to help them visualize that story. And what we're finding in our research with relapsing remitting MS is that this is engaging additional brain regions. So we're seeing additional patterns of cerebral activation or additional brain activity after patients are using the technique as compared with before. We're also seeing improvements in the amount of information someone can remember on our standardized tests. And probably most importantly, patients are reporting improvements in their everyday life, in their memory function, in their daily life, and so are their significant others. So we're seeing some tremendous results in relapsing remitting MS. And what we're now doing through the help of the Alliance is we're taking these results that we've achieved in relapsing remitting MS and we're testing them stringently in progressive MS in the hopes that it works just as well in that population. If it doesn't work just as well in that population, then we'll modify it and we'll get it to work just as well in that population.
Well, so it sounds like what you're hoping is that based on some of the work you're doing in relapsing, that you know, you'll see similar results hopefully in progressive MS as well as, and if need be, you know, retool it a little bit. But it sounds also like that what you're hoping for, and let me know if I'm getting this right, if I'm drawing the right conclusion, is that this technique, after it's gone through a little more research and validation, is something that a person with MS could go in when they're going to see their doctor and they're saying, you know, I'm having some trouble, you know, remembering, and you know, it's just something that I can do. They could refer them to a psychologist or even have a tool set that could say, okay, try this and let's see if this can make a difference in your life. And so it sounds to me that that's what you're going for, right? It's something that somebody can use in their everyday life, even
yes.
perhaps make an app out of at some point.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Carry on their
and
phone.
Actually, we're already releasing it to clinicians around the world. There are 12 different centers around the world that already have the treatment protocol and are using it.
Mm-hmm.
And we are exploring options to increase the use of it through technology, through both telerehabilitation and potentially app development.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So that is real world. I mean, really exciting to see how that could be applied and make a difference in people's lives. So thank you, Nancy. That is really exciting and inspiring. So let's shift gears just slightly. And I'm going to talk to David Pitt. So So similar question, David, to what I posed to Nancy. I'm interested in your impressions of the alliance and what you hope it'll achieve for people with MS.
Well, I think the alliance not only helps with funding, that is certainly one focus or one function, but it also, I think, helps to shift the research agenda in multiple sclerosis. So I remember when I started in MS research over 10 years ago, progression didn't seem to be very interesting to the research community. Nobody was doing really research on this. And the Alliance now has put a spotlight on progressive MS and thereby kind of shapes and redefines the agenda in MS research in the academic community, I think, but probably also in the biotech community. And I think it does with good success. As I can tell you that progression has become very much the buzzword in the halls of MS research.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I know that you're a neurologist. You're also a pathologist, which basically means you try to figure out, you know, and understand what's causing, you know, the damage in MS. Before we launch into your project, you know, perhaps could you give us some context of why does the disease progress differently in some people, where some people seem to progress more rapidly than others? Is this tied to brain changes that you're seeing in these different patients?
So, first of all, you're quite right. It's an well-known clinical observation that some patients with chronic MS, for example, that they are very stable or they have very mild progression, and then there are other patients who deteriorate very fast, so they have severe progression. And what we know is that it doesn't seem to be necessarily linked to, let's say, the amount of white matter lesions in the brain of that person. So inflammation might play a role to some degree, sure, but it's not sufficient to explain these stark differences between patients. So I think, and there's increasingly the feeling that there are probably rather small differences in the function of brain cells in different patients that might determine how MS affects the brain, how inflammation affects the brain. So on one hand, you have the inflammatory attack on the brain, and on the other hand, you have possibly the sensitivity or the resilience of brain cells to this inflammatory attack. And that might very much contribute to the ultimate outcome in MS. So I think in the general human population, there are many small variations in the function and the structure of brain cells. And these variations usually don't have any impact. You wouldn't know that you have slightly different, that you have slight variations from the next person. But once the person develops a neurological disease, MS, for example, then suddenly these variations matter because they might determine how the MS goes for that patient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about your research. I was interested in the fact that you're studying a brain chemical called glutamate. And so, first of all, what is glutamate, and what does that have to do with progressive MS?
So glutamate is really a very special molecule, I think. It's an amino acid, first of all. And as you said, it acts in the brain as a neurotransmitter. That means it's being released by nerve cells, and it can also be sensed by other nerve cells. And that's how nerve cells talk to each other in the brain. So glutamate is really very necessary for brain function. But too much glutamate can damage nerve cells, and that's why there is a very tight regulation of glutamate in the brain to keep the glutamate concentrations low, to keep them down. But this regulation can fail, and then too much glutamate can kill nerve cells, and then it's called glutamate toxicity. And we know that this is an important mechanism in a number of neurological diseases. In fact, it plays a major role in stroke, in Alzheimer's disease, in Parkinson's disease, in ALS, and also in multiple sclerosis. So why I think glutamate might have something to do with progression is because there was recently a study that looked at a certain group of MS patients. And these MS patients, they had high levels of glutamate in the brain, elevated glutamate levels. Mm. And these patients, they were doing poorly. They had rapid progression. And also they had, what they also shared was that they had a certain set of genetic variations that were all related to glutamate biology. Mm. So I'm thinking, and other people are thinking, that in this particular group of patients, the glutamate handling in the brain is impaired, and therefore these brain cells are more prone to glutamate toxicity. And this is the reason why these patients are doing poorly. So this is what we want to tease out in this study that the Alliance is.
I see. So something that is normally used for good in terms of cells talking to each other, when it gets a little off, it can be bad. So that is important that we look at that. So just shifting gears, I know that besides glutamate, you are also studying stem cells. And, part of the work that you're doing is, taking a person's own skin cells, turning them into nerve stem cells using a technology called iPSC, and then growing those up in laboratory dishes. This is interesting and exciting new technology. Tell me a little bit about why you're doing this work and what you hope it's going to tell us.
Well, it sounds like science fiction, and although we are doing that in our lab now for over a year, it still feels like science fiction to me. And by the way, the researcher who developed this technique got a Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2012. So this mm-hmm. is really seen as a major milestone in stem cell biology in general, but also in medicine. So what we are doing, we are combining these two approaches, these ideas about glutamate and stem cells, and we are using stem cells to prove that. So what we are doing is we are taking a skin biopsy from a person, and from these skin cells, we can make so-called inducible pluripotent stem cells. And we can use these stem cells and develop them further into neurons or other brain cells or, in fact, any other cells of the human body. So we are making neurons and astrocytes out of that. And the beauty of this approach is that now these neurons in the dish, they have exactly the same genetic makeup as the neurons in the brain of a person from which the skin biopsy was derived. So we have now this genetic, the special genetic constellation that might make this patient prone to glutamate toxicity. We have that now in neurons, in nerve cells in the dish. And this allows us now to test whether brain cells that come from a patient with this glutamate problem, whether these neurons are particularly sensitive to glutamate. And if we have shown that patients with these glutamate genes, that they are doing worse because of the activation of the glutamate pathway, then we have really defined this mechanism of glutamate toxicity in this subset of patients.
So if I could connect the dots, what your research seems to be saying is that you did some work that then and others have shown that glutamate, this molecule that is involved in communicating with nerve cells, can be damaging to nerve cells in MS if it's in too high a concentration in a person's brain. And it sounds like what your idea is that there might be something in an individual's genetic makeup who lives with MS that makes their nerve cells more sensitive to glutamate than someone else. And so the way to test that question is to actually try to make nerve cells, that have the same genetic makeup of a person with MS. So you are doing that in the laboratory dish with, contributions that people with MS have given you, their own stem cells, and trying to make unique, basically what are nerve cells from that have all the properties as though they were inside the brain of somebody who lives with MS. Does that sound about what you're saying?
That's exactly right. You should write my grants, I think.
Okay, so you're basically trying to you're recreating the brain in a laboratory dish. That's pretty cool. What are you hoping ultimately comes out of this?
So first of all, we can identify these patients if this all turns out to be true, that glutamate really affects glutamate toxicity affects a certain subset of patients. So first of all, we can identify these patients, right? And then there are a number of compounds that are FDA approved. They are used for other purposes, and these are antibiotics, for example, or Alzheimer's drugs that affect the glutamate pathway, that ameliorate the glutamate pathway. And these medications, they could be given to these specific patients, and they might help fix their problem, this glutamate problem. It might not be suitable for other patients who don't have that problem, but for these patients, it would be right. So this would be individualized therapy for progressive MS patients, if you will. And I think this is only the beginning, because it's very likely that other patients are vulnerable to other modes of cell death, not glutamate toxicity, but other modes of cell death, like oxidative stress, for example. And we have to identify who these patients are and what their triggers are for neuronal death, and then we can identify what specific treatments might work for them. But that will be another project.
I see. And so just to try to link up what you're doing and what Nancy are doing, because you clearly are working in two different areas. Nancy's, you know, working in people and sort of addressing some of the issues that are happening in MS. Would it be fair to say that, you know, and this would be a question for both of you, that the work you're doing, David, I mean, links into the work that Nancy's doing, in the sense that we, you know, it's very likely that some of the cognitive challenges people are experiencing is because they're losing nerve cells as a result of the kinds of things that are happening in the work that David is exploring. And so this work is actually kind of linked together in that sense, even though the two of you really aren't formally collaborating.
I think that's correct.
You're looking at the same from different angles, right? I'm trying to ultimately prevent neuronal damage if I can, and Nancy is looking at how the brain, correct me if I'm not right, but how the brain can kind of circumnavigate certain aspects of neurodegeneration.
I think that's exactly true, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you both. I know that there's a number of folks on the line, and so I want to just sort of transition to say, you know, this is what you've just heard are, you know, in our discussions with Nancy and David are just an example of, you know, two of the researchers that are being funded through the Alliance. There's another many that are being funded in different aspects, but it gives you the sense of how we're aiming to be both try to get at some of the what are some of the causes of some of the damage that's seen in progressive MS, but also get at some solutions, real-world solutions that could be applied today in people who live with relapsing MS, and we hope soon in progressive MS. So now what we want to do is spend a little time with you, our listeners, giving you a chance to ask myself, Nancy, David, or Doug, a question. These are going to be facilitated by our operators. So, operator, I'll give you an opportunity to give us instructions on how individuals can pose a question.
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Mm-hmm. Okay. While we're compiling the Q&A roster, I do want to come back to a question that's come in ahead of schedule, and ask, you know, one of the things that we're seeing, you know, the ALS research challenge was a really, you know, a great thing that a lot of people have paid a lot of attention to. And I'd like for both Nancy and David, you know, other diseases, other neurological diseases can help us understand what's happening in MS and vice versa. So I wonder, if you had some perspectives to share on how, you know, Nancy, the work that you're doing in traumatic brain injury can inform MS, and David, I know you work in other diseases. How does that research help you both think about MS, and also are there breakthroughs in MS that can help people with other neurological diseases?
Should I go first?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, Nancy.
So a lot of the work I do, when you look at the literature in traumatic brain injury in regard to cognitive rehabilitation, a lot has been done over the years. So there are many different research protocols, many different treatment protocols out there. that have been researched, some more, some less, but they're out there and they're available. And one of the things that I did when I first started trying to address the problem of cognitive deficits in MS is I looked to the TBI literature, and I took some of the protocols that are available in the TBI literature and adapted them for persons with MS. The cognitive deficits we see are very different, both in their pattern and in their severity. So the same protocol doesn't work equally effectively in both populations, but if they're adapted appropriately, they can very often, some of the knowledge we know about TBI can certainly inform us as to what we can do to help persons with MS. And the opposite is also true. Some of the work that I've done in MS, I've taken and applied to traumatic brain injury. The pattern of results I'm getting is different, which means that when clinicians are actually working with patients, they need to prescribe the treatment differently and modify it to be more appropriate for the particular patient that they're working with and the illness or the injury that that patient is dealing with.
Excellent. Thank you. David?
Yeah, so for me as a researcher and as a pathologist, I think comparing MS with other diseases brings into focus both similarities that these two diseases share and differences that where they're really different, these two diseases. So obviously I'm interested in nerve cell loss, in neurodegeneration and multiple sclerosis, and there are other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease, and I do research on that as well. But it also highlights, but I'm also impressed by the differences between different diseases. For example, I'm looking also at brain tumors. I just started this project. And I look at the inflammation in brain tumors and the inflammation in multiple sclerosis. And I see that there are very stark differences, that they are kind of the opposite ends of the inflammatory spectrum. So yes, it is very informative to compare MS to disease.
Okay, great. So, operator, could you give let us know who's on the line and has an interesting question?
Yes, sir. Your first question comes from the line of Kathy Fishman.
Hi. Oh, hi, everybody.
Hello. Hi, Kathy. Yep.
I'm also a WashU graduate, and so that is really cool. So, Nancy, you mentioned your cognition and memory testing that you do for people with changes. At what stage do you feel that's appropriate? When somebody comes into your office and they say, by the way, I've been having some changes, or my sister has very advanced primary progressive and obviously with some cognitive changes, but I'm just curious if that would even be appropriate for her.
So that's a really good question. One of the challenges that we have with people in general is people tend to focus on their memory, and that's obviously because we use it so often, we're so reliant on it. But what in fact people are coming in and saying is a memory problem, that they're having problems with their memory every day, it's not necessarily memory. So the first thing people need to do, MS patients and other patients alike, is to get a full neuropsychological evaluation and figure out where the deficits really are. Because it's very important that the clinician treats the deficit that the person is having. And in MS, it could be in memory functioning, but our research is showing that it could also be in processing speed. And if someone has a processing speed impairment, it might be more efficacious for that person to treat the processing speed impairment first. So that would be my first piece of advice, is to get that full assessment and see exactly where the treatment should be targeted. Second, to be honest with you, after I started working with this memory paradigm, I think my memory got better. So I don't think you need to have deficits to actually improve from this treatment. So even if the deficits are more subtle and someone would come in to complete the treatment, I think they would see an improvement in their memory functioning afterwards, because the strategies that we're teaching are applicable to everyone. In regard to the more progressed disease where you may be having more severe deficits, I think that depends on the individual patient, but it never hurts to try.
Okay. You alluded to 12 centers in the country. I'm in Seattle. Is one of those UW or Swedish or?
No, I don't think there are any in Washington State. But if you go to a clinician or a rehab hospital or, you know, a psychologist, speech therapist, and you tell them that this is treatment that you would want to try and give them our contact information, we can get it out to them.
So I'm a rehab physical therapist, and I am very interested in the Progressive Alliance. Do any of you have any recommendations for, not so much fundraising, but I would love to be hands-on help with, is there something in Seattle that, or tell me how I can be a help.
So I think... In Seattle, or I think there are a couple ways you can help. One is, obviously, you're very engaged, and we're actually, Doug and I have been actively looking for volunteers, individuals who live with MS, to participate and you know, sort of serve as potential, you know, reviewers and participants in the process to provide that perspective. I also, you know, we are going to be, as Doug mentioned, launching a new call for proposals that are for large-scale rehabilitative studies, not large-scale collaborative studies, in which rehab will actually be part of that equation. And so I think, you know, as those projects unfold, I would expect that there'll be some teams from the, you know, Seattle area competing for those. So I think, as you know, we don't have those as yet, but I think if once that program begins, I'm sure they'll be looking for participants and people to provide, you know, stakeholder engagement. So I think when those are announced, those would be great opportunities for you to participate as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Operator, could you get us our next question?
Yes. Your next question comes from the line of Dean Smith.
Hello, Dean. Welcome. Dean, if you're talking, we can't hear you. You must be on mute.
Yes, sorry about that. I had to take it off.
All right.
Can you hear me now?
We can.
Okay, great. So I'm a 46-year-old, was diagnosed with PPMS about 15 years ago. I've experienced the, you know, progression for the 15 years. It's all on my left side. The question that I have is surrounding Ampira. I tried Ampira a couple of years ago, and took the medication as prescribed for about 14 days, and then on about the 14th or 15th day, I got out of bed and noticed what I said, about a 50 to 60% improvement. My wife said it's probably more like 30 to 40% improvement. But noticed significant improvement in my walking ability for about 10 days. And then on the 11th day, I went right back to where I was 10 days earlier. So my question is, really two parts, is there any research going into what causes that short-term improvement, because it seems to be common in most Ampira patients, and is there also any research into going into what causes that improvement in walking ability in Ampira, and how can we expand upon the time that the benefits last?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that's a great question, and hopefully I'm not too disappointing in my responses. I think we're trying to figure out what causes that. You know, I know that the company that develops Ampira is trying to sort out. I know David, who sees patients, mentioned, David, you see that as well, don't you? With some of your patients.
Right, that's true. So first of all, only about, you know, one-third of patients, 30 to 40% of patients, respond to this drug in the first place, to Ampira. And then in certain percentage of patients who respond to Ampira, they don't, just as you're describing it, they lose this benefit again. And while there's an overall idea how Ampira works, it's really a potassium channel blocker that makes sure that potassium doesn't leak out of nerve cells. It's not clear why it works only in a small portion of patients and why some patients, you know, stop responding to it. What I can tell you is I sometimes increase the dose, although that's not really, that's an hairy issue because it can induce seizures. But sometimes in some patients, I give them a third dose, or I recommend drug holidays so that the patient goes off for 1 month of this drug completely and then restarts it again in the hope that he responds anew to Ampira. And this seems to work out, at least in some patients. With regard to research, yeah, I can name you two researchers who are looking into this business of potassium channels changes in potassium channels in MS patients. So there is some research being done on this topic.
Thank you, Dean, for that question. Appreciate it.
I had tried that method of stopping and restarting. Unfortunately, it didn't work for me, so I'm particularly interested in all the research to improve walking ability because that is really the only thing that affects me in my PPMS, fortunately or unfortunately, however you look at it. So thank you.
Well, and what I can tell you, Dean, is that, you know, part of the focus of the Alliance's work is to think about, you know, other ways to improve the daily, you know, things such as walking, moving, and the like, without necessarily having to use drug treatments, but through other strategies like rehabilitation, exercise training, and so that's a focus area for the Alliance as well, because you know, there are some of these surprises like we're seeing with Ampira. So thank you again for your question and support, operator. I'll take our next question.
Yes, your final question comes from the line of Cynthia Tobin.
Hello, Cynthia. Welcome.
Hi. I'm kind of building on the last question that the gentleman asked about Ampira. I am secondary progressive MS, and I just went to the neurologist today, and she said, you know, you are significantly better than you were in May of 2013. So it's like, wow. Isn't that great? But
that is great.
Do they ever compare Ampira did nothing for me, to aminopyridine? And if they don't, why not? And do you ever do studies on LDN? I take both of those, and I know, you know, no doctors really like them, but I think they really help. And in addition to eating right and my exercise regime, I think that's saving me. And I do take Tecfidera. So I do take one big MS medicine. But do they ever do any testing in that?
David, would you like to give that?
I think I didn't quite understand what you said. You're taking 4-aminopyridine as well, or 4-aminopyridine works for you and Ampira doesn't. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, I mean, 4-aminopyridine, we knew works a long time ago, and there was this fear of 4-aminopyridine being able to induce seizures, at least in some patients. And I think Ampira is kind of a derivative of that, and it's, you know, in slow-release medication, so the chances that it induces seizures is much lower. I must say I haven't heard of patients who respond to one drug but not to the other, so I'm quite surprised, and I'm glad that it works for you, but I'm not sure how to explain that.
Yeah. Well,
but
thank you.
No,
and
testing done. Okay.
I don't know. At this point, Cynthia, I think we haven't quite done the comparison. I think what you're wondering is, are people looking at 4-aminopyridine versus Ampira, comparing them to each other, basically?
Well, my results, I mean, the 4-AP is just great. I work every day.
Right.
And
yeah,
the aminopyridine did absolutely nothing for me.
And
I'm still just on 20 milligrams. I don't take more than that. I know some people that do. But.
Yeah, no, I think I'll have to ask some colleagues, but I don't know that it's been looked at quite that way. But, you know, that was I appreciate that observation, and certainly something I'll ask the company when I talk to them next.
And can I make
Thank
one other
you.
Comment? The one
sure.
thing I always hear from MS patients, which I've got several friends that have MS, is that, you know, there's no money behind 4-AP because it's compounding pharmacists. There's no money behind LDN. So no research gets done in those areas. And, you know, I don't know what to say, but I don't know. Is that possibly a reason that I know the drug companies aren't going to do research in that area because they're not going to get paid? Is that why there's no research on it?
Well, I think in the case of 4-AP, there's 4-aminopyridine. Because Ampyra is 4-aminopyridine as well, just released a little bit slower, Acorda has, the rights for that. So I think that's part of the reason for the 4-AP part of it. You know, LDN, we have funded some research in that area. Some other people have. I think there's still some mixed results around that, but I do know that there are some additional researchers doing trials with it. So I think they're trying to get, you know, some answers around that. But I appreciate your question that, trying to find some of these promising leads sometimes can be a little bit challenging. So, but as we think about our research strategies going forward, this is definitely an area that we're looking at. And, you know, to your point about using wellness, exercise, and the like, we are adding that also and beginning to expand our investments in things such as exploring, you know, healthy diet, what's the impact on a person's disease. So we that also is part of our agenda. So, be on the lookout for some updates from us around that as well. Thank you again, Cynthia. I have one last question from Brent, who sent in a question ahead of time, and I want to pose that to David and Nancy as to what, as you look at progressive MS research over the last 4 to 5 years, you know, in your opinion, in your area of research, what would you say was the biggest breakthrough?
Nancy, if you want to go first.
Sure. I think in regards to progressive MS, what we've made the most progress in is being able to distinguish what the cognitive deficits are in progressive MS and how they're different from relapsing remitting MS. Now, there's more work to be done. I don't think we're finished. But I think we've made a lot of progress. And the reason that's important, some people think it's not important to actually identify the deficits, but in reality, that is a very, very important basis of treatment. You can't prescribe the appropriate treatment if you don't know what you're treating. So it's really important that we fully understand what the deficits people are experiencing are before we start to treat it. And I think that the identification of these deficits and how they differ from relapsing remitting MS have really pushed us forward in an attempt to start to treat those deficits.
Thank you. David?
So from my perspective, I think what springs to mind is that there was a discovery that inflammation in progressive MS, that inflammation might contribute to that a lot. So initially it was thought that this is some mysterious neurodegenerative disease. The relapsing remitting phase is all inflammation, and after that we have some neurodegenerative disease that is completely independent of inflammation. And I think this is not true anymore. So for example, it was found that there are some like lymph node-like follicles. They form in the meninges of MS patients, and they are full with immune cells. And these immune cells are now behind a closed blood-brain barrier, so that means they don't have to come in from the outside anymore. They are in the brain now. And that this might be a cause of severe progression. So I think that gives us an important lead on how to address this type.
Right. Thank you. So, and I'll just give you my opinion on also what important breakthrough. I think a year or so ago, there was a clinical trial of the cholesterol-lowering drug Lipitor, known generically as simvastatin, in people who live with secondary progressive MS. And what they found was that that drug in the phase 2 trial actually led to individuals having improvement in their MS, both in terms of their MRI, but also in terms of them actually physically doing better. So that was very exciting results, and we're now, first of all, it gives us hope that through clinical trials we could identify treatments that can make a difference in the lives of people with progressive MS, but also set the stage for a phase 3 clinical trial of this potential drug. So lots of exciting stuff happening. The Alliance really represents, you know, one part of a global approach that all of our societies are taking to tackle progressive MS. Thank you all for your questions. Certainly, if there are other questions, feel free to email them in to Erica to Clerk. I'm happy to turn the floor back to Erica to close out the call.
Thank you so much, Tim and Nancy and David and Doug. I'm sure I speak for everyone on the line. just to express our appreciation for all that you've shared and inspired us with about the significant progress being made in MS research. Before we do close, yes, I'd like to reiterate that we welcome any further questions you have, either sending them to me or to your society staff contact, and to continue to check the society's website to stay current on other research advancements as well as breaking news. Thank you to each of you, our listeners, for joining us today. Your wonderful support is truly helping people with MS live their very best lives while we drive research to stop the disease in its tracks, restore what's been lost, and end MS forever. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day. Adrian, I will turn it back to you to close the call.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.